Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and we're going to be traveling to the Philippines. Yes, turn on your imagination and join us, because we're going to be discussing a historical place that a book, The Silent Sentinel, is based upon. And my guest is James Edward Cleland. We're going to be talking about the San Pablo Apostol de Cabagan Church, which has 300 years of secrets in the Philippines. Has that intrigued you at all? Well, I hope so. I'm a lover of history. In fact, I find that there's so many things historically that we never, ever imagined went on. We get so caught up with our politics of the day that we forget about what went before. So we're going to go into that a little bit. James Cleland, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you very much, Ms. Sebo. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, so am I. Now, you are an educator, and you have your degrees. You've just been involved with teaching since 1981, but you have had an interest in architectural history.
Yes, ma'am.
And you have decided that you wanted to really do some research on this old church in the Philippines. And what spurred this interest? Because the Philippines is a long way from Chicago. How did you get involved with finding out about this unique building?
That's a very good question. My wife is a Filipina. She is an Ibanag Filipino from the area of northern Luzon where the church is located, and it happens to be her family church. And she had come back from visiting her family, maybe 12 years ago or so, and I saw some photographs she had taken. This is before I had yet to visit the Philippines for my first visit. And I was stunned that it looked just like our Spanish missions in the Southwest, in Texas or Arizona or California. I was absolutely floored. So my curiosity was piqued, and I wanted to find out as much about it as I could.
So that was the trigger.
That was the trigger.
Now, before we went on air, you were telling me that your research, because you teach full-time, it has taken you over 8 years. And
correct.
You really did a lot of digging. You became a history detective, so to speak. And you found that there was so much to this. Where did you begin your research? What was it that you found you had to start with? Because when we think of a detective, and that's what I'll use because I think it's an appropriate word, an investigator, how do you choose where you're going to begin?
You're asking very good questions. I teach architecture and design at a Jesuit high school in the northern suburbs of Chicago. It's called Loyola Academy. So my background has always been pretty solid in U.S. history. So I was aware of the Spanish colonization of the United States and the missions of Father Serra and the missions in San Antonio and the missions in Arizona. And so I decided to begin by not reading so much about the missions, but reading about the history of the Philippines, which I knew very little about. I think I remembered something from my grammar school days of Commodore George Dewey, and something very loosely about the Spanish-American War. But I realized I was completely ignorant in the background. So I would say pretty much the first 3 years was reading everything I could get by and about the Philippines, by Philippine authors who were considered expert in their field. Dr. Agoncillo comes to mind. There are many wonderful writers. And I was just floored by how little I knew, and I just had to absorb as much as I could so I could begin to put this church in its proper context. And as I got a bit more comfortable with the history of the Philippines, I realized there are so many stories that were waiting to be revealed, at least to us in America, which I don't even know if the Filipino people themselves knew much about it.
Mm-hmm.
But there was forced migrations of three complete different groups of Filipino ethnic subdivisions in this very area where the church was located. It originally was built by the Iraya people. It then was maintained and further refined by the Ibanag people, which my wife was a member of. And then it was left to the Ilocano people, who were brought in by the Spanish, right before the Spanish-American War, to further develop the missionary activity there. And I'm very happy to say that, unlike other parts of the Philippines and certainly other parts of the world where the Spanish colonizations were, to be quite honest, terrible and, and unlawful,
brutal.
Here in Cabagan, the people and the Spanish priests got along brilliantly. As a matter of fact, some facts that had some of Filipino professors upset when I was revealing them in my visit in 2006, the people came to try to rescue the Spanish missionaries when the revolutionaries were coming to free them from Spanish rule. And I thought the irony there was just unbelievable.
Fascinating stuff. Now, let's for a moment just stop and think. How many islands are in the Philippines?
I'm going to guess in the area 7,200.
They're
actually on the map.
Incredible amount of land when you think of it.
Oh, yeah.
Over 7,000. I had no idea it was that much. I thought it was hundreds. I thought it was more like 700, but not 7,000. That's incredible.
Oh, it is phenomenal. And although it's very easy for Americans to travel to Manila and then to go north on Luzon, you'd have to take a boat to get to some of the other islands, but then you'd have to take planes to get to the far-out islands, which is something I'd like to do in my next travel over there.
Now, there's a lot of discord that goes on in the Philippines, but let's travel back in history a little bit, because the Spanish influence on the islands, I mean, out of 7,000 islands, how many were they able to even get to know? I mean, who did all the work on tracking all of these islands? That's a lot of land to cover.
Well, the Filipino professors whom I've consulted like to use the term frailocracy, which can be very easily translated into friarocracy. The Spanish friars who were brought from Spain by way of Mexico and then all the way across the Pacific to the Philippines, they were like the people who would make sure that the river settlements would be brought in, that they would bring the people in initially from the riverbanks where they wanted to live because of fishing as their livelihood, and they would form villages, just like in our American Southwest.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to use the architecture that was familiar to the Spanish conquistadors and the missionaries. But one of the really fun facts I gleaned when doing this research, the Spanish idea of having a mission complex surrounded by a small atrium wall was first used in this church. It was not used anywhere else in any Spanish colony before that time.
Amazing.
And at the San Pablo Church, they explored really large arches to support a second floor, what would eventually become a choir loft. But back then it was just a means to access the bell tower. So there were some really breathtaking developments in architecture that were associated with this church, which is one of the reasons I give that it should be saved. It is very unique around the world for that reason. One of the other reasons why I've fallen in love with this church is everyone has told me it cannot be saved, it should not be saved, it is too old, it is in too bad condition. But when I studied it, it was in certainly no worse condition than our own Alamo and San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember some of the beautiful missions of Father Junipero Serra. They were not exactly in great shape necessarily in the beginning either. But this one needs a roof, and this one needs continued waterproofing.
Mm-hmm.
But it is the largest church, short of being a cathedral, and the third oldest church in all of Asia that was dedicated to the Roman Catholic Church. So there's a lot of wonderful reasons why I think this church can and should be saved. And yes, the people, especially, yeah, people really want to save history. It.
Yes, it would, because it's a part of history, good, better, and different. But like you said, they were fortunate. They didn't have a lot of what other areas experienced, because the Spanish takeovers were horrifically brutal historically.
Oh, yes.
The Philippines, one of the first things that you bring out in your book is the independent nature of the Filipino people and how they were always fighting for independence. Now, when did the Spaniards come in? What was the time frame when they started, if you will, invading the islands to say, this is ours?
Well, actually, within one person's lifetime, Ferdinand Magellan kind of got the ball rolling when the Pope at the time gave the ruling of that part of the Pacific to the government of Spain. And we think that the initial foundation for the church was somewhere in the 1620s, so that wouldn't be too far away from Magellan's lifetime, you know, had he lived, had he not died at the hands of the local natives. And so the foundation for this church goes way back to, pretty similar to our own St. Augustine in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And then this particular church went up in 1735. We're pretty clear on that because there was an earlier church that was burned down due to the unfortunate accident of a little boy who burned, started the fire, and it kind of burned the wooden timbers that were supporting the old structure. And there is some disagreement as to whether or not the San Pablo church that we see today was built on the remains of an earlier church or if it was new from the ground up. But we're pretty certain on the date 1735, which would be very similar to our own French and Indian War right before our own American Revolution. So there's wonderful parallels
to
help us gauge the time period. And the church was moved several times because the friars and the Indios, as they called the native Filipino people, they were too close to other villages, and they were afraid that a church this magnificent was going to lose out on some of the support of the population because there were so many nearby churches. They actually literally, in one case, moved the roof first, a true story, without the walls, and then the Spanish government decided, no, we'll put it back where it was, and they had to return the roof to its location. So this roof is no stranger to being moved and destroyed. It has withstood earthquakes, a cholera epidemic about 50 years after it was started, and it withstood some Spanish manipulation of the local economy through what we call the estanco or the tobacco monopoly. In this case, the Spanish government wanted to try to maximize the profits from a few number of tobacco-growing missions, San Pablo unfortunately not being one of them, even though it has some of the finest tobacco in the world. It even rivals that of the Cuban cigar industry.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
And the king himself preferred the tobacco from the Philippines over that of Cuba. But then they realized that because the tobacco monopoly was not working and the people were leaving to where they could grow tobacco, the people, both the men who would be building eventually schools and further refinements to the mission complex, were leaving, and then their wives, who would in many cases provide the knowledge of the adobe making and the firing of the bricks, they left too. So the Spanish had to realize that they made a terrible mistake, and then they repealed their own monopoly about one generation after that, and people started coming back to the Cabacan area.
Isn't it amazing how actions affect the economics
and
people? I mean, we're going through the same kind of thing here in the U.S. It's on a different level, but it's the same stuff. When people are not wise, the market...
The parallels are incredible. Yeah.
Yeah, the parallels are absolutely amazing. Now, you mention in your book, well, you said it just now, that the women were very skilled in working with adobe, but there was a Jesuit friar, Antonio Sedino, that taught the Filipino and Chinese adoberos what was required to build a house of adobe. Now,
correct.
For some reason, I never, and you'd mentioned this a moment ago, I would have never thought that Adobe, I think of that in the southwestern area of the United States, California, down in Mexico, but in the Philippines? That was amazing to me. I never thought that that was the type of soil that they used.
They really had to, because there was a lack of rock and quarries. They really had to go with what they knew. In some cases, some of the churches that came immediately after San Pablo, Misibo, would experiment with all fire-baked clay, which would make it very much weather-resistant. But with San Pablo, they still used the tried-and-true method of a lot of rubble, a lot of actual dirt, and then a little bit of well-placed clay. And some of the tile that they baked would be more for decorative purposes than it would be for actually strengthening it. And one of my great memories of my 2006 trip to the Philippines is sitting, enjoying a lemonade with one of the archdiocesan priests there who was responsible for getting the renovation started at San Pablo. And he told me that, he goes, you know, Jim, nobody knows exactly how the Indios made the brick. And there have been all sorts of theories, and a lot of people have claimed they know, but nobody knows. We have not been able to analyze exactly why it is so sturdy and so brightly colored, full, and beautiful.
Amazing.
And we had hoped that since we had found the kiln that was used to bake the clay for the San Pablo Church, it was about maybe 300 yards away from the bell tower. And then to my horrors, I find out that my representative in the Philippines, a young professor by the name of Lynn Galima, so he told me that after the book came out, there was such a interest in that area, people walked off and vandalized the kiln. They took the bricks because the horno, as the Spanish called it, the conically shaped oven was in such good shape, people wanted to reuse the bricks. So now we've lost the bricks to be able to study. Yeah, you can't win for trying, you know.
Oh, my goodness. Well, maybe somebody will volunteer to give up their brick. But that's amazing. It was not possible to analyze it. It reminds me of the story about the concrete that the Romans developed.
Yes.
It is still strong and sturdy.
You do
and
know
they
your
have
history.
Not been,
oh,
yeah,
boy.
And they do not know how that was made. There's something missing that they have not figured out. The combination of materials, because that concrete around the Roman Colosseum that's been used, you know, in water environments, I mean, it's thousands of years old, and it's strong, whereas the concrete that we make today, not unlike the typical bricks, in 100 years, it's deteriorating. It's like it's reached its strength and stamina, and then it goes away. So these things are amazing, and I think it's fascinating stuff, because when we think that we're so sophisticated, we are not, even with all of our technology, able to break down the components that, you know, that made those bricks in the Philippines. Now, the Philippines get a lot of rain. Am I right or am I wrong? And how How does the adobe weather that? I mean, I would just think that unless the clay was baked, they just, you know, the building would sag and the walls would go away. And how in the world can, I mean, for it to even be standing as it is today after all this time?
Well, we would put a mixture, like a waterproofing mixture over, which the Spanish call palitada. And we would, it would be very similar to like a very thin veneer of limestone, liquid limestone that's dabbled on there. When it dries, it becomes water resistant. But the problem there is, with the earthquakes and the strong winds from the typhoons, I experienced two of their Category 2 typhoons, and that was really something.
I bet.
It can blow the palitada off, and if it's not repaired immediately, a little crack becomes a gaping hole in no time. So,
wow.
What we had to do, the young parish priest in 2005 with whom I was communicating, Father Patrick Caro, he began the process of trying to waterproof the immediate sacristy area. So he took what was left of the roof, and they put a galvanized metal roof that would cover the altar and the maybe the top 20 or 30 rows of pews. So he did a pretty good job of protecting that for future renovation. But the whole great nave, and I'm not too familiar with the churches in Spokane, but I know the beautiful new cathedral in Los Angeles. To give you an idea, this church would the Los Angeles Cathedral would fit inside the San Pablo Church. This was a huge church.
That's amazing.
It's very similar in Chicago to our own Holy Name Cathedral. And the Spanish wanted to reward both the Iraya people and the Ibanags, and later the Ilocanos, for their faithfulness to the Spanish mission, that they gave them the largest church short of having a cathedral. And the people loved it. They loved having the... I have to paraphrase that a little bit. Of course, there was forced work involved, and I'm not suggesting that they enjoyed the forced work, mm-hmm. but they realized the Spanish totally respected their work ethic in giving them the largest church outside of a cathedral in all of Asia. It is huge.
Well, that's just mind-boggling, because you have photos in the book, and this architectural structure that is so old, 1600s, 1700s, then... to have it of that size. I mean, that is just amazing. And what a wonderful opportunity for this to be rebuilt, because it is history. Now, you bring up something about history. The poor Filipino people have had all kinds of groups that came through. The Muslims also came in. Tell us a little bit about the Muslim history and the interaction in the Philippines.
They were very much... Where the Philippines is very much of a trade route that would connect mainland Asia with the routes that would eventually connect with the caravan route to Mexico, and then eventually that would cross the Atlantic back to the Old World. And, of course, you could go the other way. You could go around to Africa from the Indian ports, and the Islamic routes were really responsible for populating the South West islands and areas, the Mindanao region in the Philippines. So they have maintained their culture, which is also very beautiful, and it is to see some of the Muslim dances and some of the music that comes out of the area. It really is fascinating that it's so radically different from the Spanish influence you see in the rest of the Philippines, and even the Chinese and lately, since the 1800s, the American influence is farther north. So one of the authors I had read made a fascinating comment. The reason why so many explorers and adventurers wanted to visit Manila in the 1800s and 1900s is that the Philippines people have been exposed to so many of the world's most ambitious and, at the time, progressive and successful cultures, and they successfully accommodated them, that you had an excitement unlike any other city anywhere in the world. But that did come at a price, and the price would be a lot of the Filipino people felt that there was a question mark as to what was their own identity. Mm-hmm. The Malay influence, which is where their language came from, and with its 86 dialects, was being pushed aside by both the influence of Islam to the south, the influence of Roman Catholicism everywhere else, and the influence of the American educational systems that were brought in after the War of 1898. So they were bombarded with so many cultural ideas from around the world that a lot of the people felt that they have lost their own identity. And right now, the difference you can see in the schools that I visited in 2006, half the instructions are in Filipino, which is the formal name for Tagalog, which is actually the language of the Tagalog people located north of Manila. And then the other half of the instruction time will be in English. And there are times during the day when the children are told they have to address their teachers with questions in Tagalog, and there are times when they have to address their teachers in English. And at first I thought that was going to be confusing to the kids, but it does give them a wonderful sense of identity. It mm-hmm. also makes them incredibly marketable everywhere around the world. So you'll see a huge emigration of Filipino talent, doctors, nurses, entertainers, lawyers, who can speak with ease anywhere around the world. So it's one of those situations that depends on how you look at it, but it could be a gift or it could be a curse. It depends on how you want to look at it.
One of the darker periods of the Philippines was the invasion of the Japanese during the Second World War. And you bring that out. Again, your history that you have that surrounds this. And like you said, it's 300 years of history that surround the Church San Pablo that is over 12,000 square feet and has a bell tower that's 113 feet high. I mean, this is an awesome, awesome building. Tell us how the Japanese affected this area of San Pablo.
Well, the Japanese people were already an accepted part of the Luzon Island experience long before the war. There were a lot of Japanese fishermen who migrated to the north, or I should say from the north, and despite some initial skirmishes with the natives, eventually they settled down and then generations began populating the northern regions of Luzon. And there is a wonderful professor in Tokyo. His name is Nakao Yuji. I want to thank him very much. He gave me access to a lot of the Imperial Japanese, the Army of Occupation's activities in Tegigarao and Tumaoini, the two major cities located on either side of Kabagan, as well as Kabagan. So he gave us wonderful anecdotes, many times from the diaries of the officers themselves. And another incredible story, which I did not expect to see, especially since the talk about the Kabanatuan camps that they had after the fall of Bataan and the movie that was made, The Great Raid, and all sorts of stories coming out about Japanese imprisonment of the Americans and Filipinos. Quite a few of the Japanese divisions located around Kabagan, they got along so well with the people that there were a lot of good friendships made. And Mr. Yuji mentions how they introduced soy sauce in Kabagan for the first time outside of Japan, and the people loved it. Now, I'm not trying to make light in any way of the horrors that happened, because there were horrors, and I document especially the young Filipino priest, Father Justo Manuel, who heroically gave his life. But I also wanted to point out that those Japanese leaders who were better educated and who did travel outside of Japan before the war really saw the beauty and the strength of the Philippine Islands themselves. So you had to be careful. It's very hard for anyone to draw generalizations about an occupying army, because you're going to have, you know, the very bad, you're going to have the very good, you're going to have a lot in between. But there were some interesting anecdotes and some very good friendships made that exist to this day between the Japanese and the people of the area. And there were also, of course, bitter enemies also made.
Your book is absolutely fascinating. And the restoration of the church, the raising of money, is something that is going on. It is a history. I just think you have done such an incredible job about this building that most people wouldn't even have a clue had this kind of history to it. And it's so significant architecturally, historically, the building materials, all of this. I would imagine that building designers would even be intrigued with this kind of a edifice that had been put together over 300 years ago. And to find out about it being on this particular island in the Philippines, it has over 7,000 islands, and here you have all of these things that go on. It really makes for a fascinating read. The Silent Sentinel. What is your website, James, so people can check it out?
It's the name of the book, www.thesilentsentinel.com.
And have they started renovating it again? I know there's been moments periodically when they've been involved with that. But is there ongoing renovation at this time?
It's very spotty, as each parish priest who is given the authority to preside over the church tries his best to marshal the resources. The front wall was saved from collapse by Father Pua, and Father Caro, as I mentioned earlier, had done a good job of waterproofing the sanctuary area with a temporary roof. And the current priest there, Father Cadiz, is doing some work replenishing the tile floors, and I believe he's introducing new pews. But what we're looking for is a major effort, not dissimilar from what the United Nations was doing with other heritage sites around the world. Since the UN will not touch this church because they think it's in too bad condition, that's why I really felt the challenge to try to get involved with this and see what we can do. We found a Filipino architect, Father Son Team in Los Angeles, who's interested in who actually went over to the Philippines to help us provide estimates for the cost of doing the work in phases. And we have a lot of people in Kabagan. My sister-in-law, Lita Mamawa, has been very instrumental in going, actually both of my sisters-in-law, Lily and Lita Mamawa, have been going around collecting funds and talking about the church, both in the United States as well as in Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
But we'd like to begin a really large-scale effort, not only to generate funds to rebuild the church, but we'd like to have a museum dedicated to the young priest who gave his life to save the people there, Father Justo
mm-hmm.
Manuel. And we think that once the story comes out, it's just going to become a tidal wave of interest.
Oh,
people
I think
around
so.
The world
I think
are going to...
Yeah. I agree,
I really
and I think
so.
Your book is wonderful. I really, really do. Well, I know we're out
Thank
of time,
so
James. It's been a pleasure having you as a guest. James Cleland has been my guest. He is the author and the researcher of The Silent Sentinel. And you go to the website, thesilentsentinel.com. You'll find photos. You'll find all kinds of information. And I invite you to explore it because history has so much to give us if we're willing to take the time to read, to observe, and to listen. And also, it's changed James' life, but the Filipino people have a lot to learn as well. So this has just been terrific. James, again, thank you for being my guest. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We'll be right back.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Telephone lines are now open. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Also, just know if you're a first-time listener, I just need from you your first name or your initial, and then after that, I'll give you what I perceive. And then, of course, when I'm finished chatting with you, then you're welcome to ask me a question about anything that is of importance to you. 888-815-9756. I do want to mention quickly, for those of you that might have been in the Nashville area that you were wanting to listen to the show that I was a part of on Sunday, I regret that because of the heavy flooding that occurred about a month or so ago, and oh, those poor people in the Tennessee area, the flooding, you hardly heard anything about it, but it was just as bad as New Orleans. The Grand Ole Opera, everything was affected, and the studio that I was going to be broadcasting through their equipment wasn't working because they had been flooded out so badly. So they have had major problems, so we had to cancel the show. But we've got a whole bunch of other shows that are coming up. I'm getting the schedules, and I'll be sharing that information with you. I'm going to be on a station in Birmingham, Alabama, Orlando, Florida, and perhaps Lexington, Kentucky, and here in Seattle, and I've got some other things that are going on. So we will keep you updated and informed. Meanwhile, give me a buzz if you'd like to chat at 888-815-9756. What's coming up this week? Well, I know the sun's shining wherever you are. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about some of the finest publications I've seen for kids. I really believe that with children, you want to put the right kinds of information, the seeds, for inspiration, motivation, and a standard of excellence and quality in youngsters lasts them their whole lives. We're going to be talking with Deborah Slover. This is a woman who's dedicated to that and very supportive of children having the understanding of how to be independent, how to learn how to stand on their own two feet. So she's got two books called Unique Kids. We're going to be talking about that, and then on Wednesday, we're going for Italian. Yes. One of my favorite cuisines, partially because I've got that in my background. Well, by golly, if you like Italian, and you are sort of wanting to cut back on meat, whatever, we're going to be talking about Nonna's Italian Kitchen and Italian food. Italians love their fresh vegetables and their sauces, but there's a vibrancy of flavor and texture with Italian cooking that I am just in love with. I have been for as far as I can remember. I'll never forget the first time I was ever in an Italian home and the table groaned under all of the food. Among the Italian people, it is a joy to have good food, good vino, and share it with your friends, have conversations. It's always, always been a very significant part of their culture, and I love it because it's part of my legacy. Then we're going to be talking about the science of making things happen this week. Yes. Do you believe that you can have an effect on how your life goes, the way things fall into place? Well, we're going to find out what Kim Romanier is going to be sharing with us, and then on Friday we may have a surprise guest. Oh, by the way, I wanted to let you know, Bill Nolan, who is a science fiction writer that we were supposed to have on Friday, well, bless his heart, his car broke down on him. And so he had to be towed, and there was no way that he could make the interview. So we've got him rescheduled for August because July, my July month, is just packed already with fabulous guests. But Bill's going to be with us. So if you're a sci-fi person, just know that Bill Nolan, who is renowned, he's won awards, he's just, this guy is incredible. And he is the original author of a very famous sci-fi movie called Logan's Run. In fact, it's become a cult classic. And it's quite amazing when you watch these old movies that science fiction writers put together and how far ahead they were in their thinking. I just love it. You think of Jules Verne and H.G. Wells and their visionary writing. Yes. And by golly, we're experiencing a lot of that today. The same thing with Star Trek. So it's always fun to talk with people. They have this phenomenal imagination. And we're going to be talking again with Bill. So for those of you that missed that, just know that that's what's coming up. Okay, Donna Sebo here. If you want to give me a call, that's great. 888-815-9756. Oh, have your pads of paper and pens ready too, or pen, so that I can share with you a recipe for peach and orange preserves. All of this delicious fruit is coming out. And I had a friend that said, Donna, I've got peaches in my freezer. What am I going to do with them? I can't eat them. So I'm going to be making them into preserves. But if you want to make a preserve that is just going to be fabulous for gifts for the holidays or anything like that, this recipe is really a winner. I've used it more than once. And the flavors are just awesome. I mean, hey, if you're going to get a sugar shot, why not make it really tasty? But it takes work, but it's not as much work as you think. So I'll be sharing that with you. Okay, coming up is going to be a fabulous time for fishing. Well, guys, you're going to have to move over because the gals are going to be having their own fish derby. Now, for any of you who have ever been involved with traveling to Alaska, you know Alaskans love their fishing. People come in from all over the world to fish for salmon in Alaska. It's absolutely incredible. They have all kinds of different salmon. Well, there are women that love to fish, too. Now, I can't say that I'm one of them. That, to me, is not an exciting moment, but I have a friend who, for years, her biggest passion was good to go to the biggest and best fishing hotspots in the world. Lorelei loved fly fishing, especially, and she won some awards for competition fishing. Well, coming up in August, if you wondered what you could do, gals, if you absolutely were so bored with your life and you wondered what you could do that would be unique and different, go fishing. Yes, you're going to meet some absolutely outstanding women. Now, this is what's going on. It's the Women's Silver Salmon Derby. It's occurring on August the 14th, and you can go to Valdez Fish. Let me get it here. It's ValdezFishDerbies.com, and it's ValdezFishDerbies. And you'll find out all the information on it. But this came across my desk, and I thought, this is really something special. And here is a photo of some gals wearing, if you can get this, purple and black salmon fish hats. Yes. Only women can think up these things. Anyway, and each of the women that's in this photograph have fish that are about 4 inches long, so they're like, I'd call them little fingerlings. They're not very long at all, and they've got them, the tails between their teeth. So it makes for a rather interesting photograph with these purple and black salmon replica fish on their head and the real thing hanging out of their mouth. Well, this is absolutely an incredible thing. It's known as the Women's Silver Salmon Sisterhood Derby. Try saying that fast 5 times in a row. And it's just all women. Yes, the gals compete against each other. And they began in 2005. And Angela Cochran came up with the idea of a woman-only fishing tournament. Do you know the first year that they offered this, 372 women signed up, and in 2009, 662, they doubled, you know, women have signed up, and organizers are expecting even more this year. They don't have the numbers out yet, but they go in for 10-hour days of fishing. Now, if that's fun to you, that's wonderful, but it's more than just going fishing. It's the camaraderie that these women have. And, oh, I have to correct myself. These purple hats are stuffed flounders. They're not salmon. I have to be corrected. So up in Valdez, it is absolutely amazing. They have award banquets. One gal, let's see, I don't remember I think in 2009 there was a winner, Christy Roden. She caught an 18.56-pound silver salmon. She was considered the champion. She won $1,000 in cash and $500 in prizes, and they said along with the bragging rights that come with that. So guys, move over. The gals have decided they're going to join your ranks, and there are going to be the derbies. Maybe eventually they'll have a competition between the guys and the gals. But this is fabulous, and I think anytime you have a chance to go up to Alaska, it's one of my favorite states, and I love all the states in the United States, but this one holds a very special place in my heart, and this derby would really be a hoot. So, hey, gals, go for it. I think I'd rather stay at the fishing lodge or whatever it is they got, and then I'll clap for everybody that would win the fish. But regardless, it's a fun activity, and I just think it's so great that the women have decided to get involved. This is Donna Sebo. Telephone lines are open right now if you'd like to call in and let me light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. 888-815-9756. We're taking a break. We're going to be right back. Oh, get that pad of paper and a pen. We'll be right back.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Ged Rose. Buy it today. 800-872-8852.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. I've got a recipe for you. If you love peaches, and you know, I do, but so often I find if I get large amounts of fruit with the heat, it doesn't take long for them to turn. Well, years ago, and partially this is because of my grandmother, I wanted to do preserves. And my grandmother is totally responsible for my palate passion for fruit preserves. Jellies, they're okay. I love the texture of the real fruit in the preserves. And when I was a little girl, my grandmother, because of having been raised on the farm, she was born in 1900, it was a routine every year on the farm, because during the winter months you didn't have fruit. So you would can and you'd preserve everything you could. Summertime wasn't time for play for the women on the farm. They had to cook and they had to do all kinds of things. Well, I can remember our getting packages of blackberry preserves and raspberry preserves. And, oh, man alive, I could just eat it out by the spoonful, you know, and she'd save all of her jars. And when she fixed it, she used paraffin. Well, I don't use paraffin when I do my preserves. So I found that I had a knack for it like she did, and a few years ago I started doing it. And I'm telling you, there's nothing to equal homemade preserves. So if you want to use some peaches, and a tip that I'll give you, if you know of any farmers markets and they're selling fresh fruit, check with them at the end of the day, because often they have fruits that are a little bit bruised, or, you know, they're going to be spoiling pretty quickly. And there were some special peaches that had like a very white flesh to them. It's just absolutely awesome. And I can remember my first time that I fixed these preserves, I went and I bought all of these peaches, and I think I got them for $2. It must have been about 20 pounds of peaches. Well, of course, you had to peel them, and you had to take out the bruised flesh, because you're not going to put that in your preserve mixture. But man, oh man, this recipe was incredible. And about half of what I had gotten for $2, like I said, it was about 15 to 20 pounds of peaches, because they had to get rid of them. And so they said, hey, if you want them, just come in and buy them. And that's what we did. So if you are on a budget and you know some farmers, ask them, say, do you have anything that's slightly bruised here that'd be good for preserves that I can get at a bargain price? And they'll almost give it to you, because they love to see the stuff put to use. Now, here's the recipe. It's a peach and orange conserve. That's what it's called. And this is what you need. You're going to need 2 large oranges, and you're going to need 1/4 cup of water. You need 18 large peaches, about 5 pounds in weight, and you're going to need sugar. So know you're going to need about as much sugar as you have weight of fruit. So you can go from 3/4 cup per quart of fruit to 1 cup per quart of fruit once you've got it all pitted and cut and everything ready to go. Then you're going to need about 1/4 cup of chopped blanched almonds. And trust me, it really makes a difference. Now, this is what you need to do. Your oranges, you want to wash them, cut them into quarters. If it has any seeds, you can get seedless oranges. But if it has any seeds, you want to remove the seeds. Then you want to put the oranges, the peel, and all into a medium fine blade of a Cuisinart, or if you have a meat grinder, you use that. But the Cuisinart works just fabulously. Then you want to add your water to your oranges, cover, and simmer that for 20 minutes. And then, while that's going on, that mixture is simmering away, you want to have a pot of boiling water. And your peaches, to get the skin off, you drop them into boiling water. Just dip them in. I put them on the end of a good-sized meat fork. Put them into the water for just a few seconds and put them in a bowl so as they're cooling. But the skin will just come off. And then you want to slice the peaches once you do that process. Doesn't take very long at all. 5 pounds sounds like a lot, but doesn't take long at all. And then you want to slice the peach meat very thin, removing any bruises. You don't want to use any of the bruised meat. And then you want to measure your fruit, and you want to add the equivalent of the sugar. And so if you end up with 5 pounds of peaches, if you end up with like 3 pounds of fruit, then you want to use about 2.5 to 3 pounds of sugar. Believe me, it makes a difference. And you want to let that mixture, the sugar and the peaches, you want to put it in a big bowl or a big pot and just let it stand for 4 hours at room temperature. Why are you doing this? Well, the sugar needs to be absorbed into the fruit. And every once in a while, take a big spoon, just stir it around, and it should be in a big pot. And then what you want to do after it's set for about 4 hours, 5 hours, once it's all mixture, and you're going to have a lot of juice with that, then you want to boil that mixture for 45 minutes to an hour until it's thick and clear. And, of course, you're going to be putting your oranges in there. You're going to add that little bit of extra water, and it's going to be really, really wonderful. You've got the equivalent of a marmalade here. It's called a conserve, but it's very much like that. Then when it's all nice and thick and clear, then you stir in your almonds at the last minute, and then you have your hot sterilized jars. It's going to give you about 5 pints. Oh, I am telling you, you may be hard-pressed to even give it away as a gift, because once you have it, it's going to be absolutely delicious. It goes beautifully with chicken. The heck with the chicken. Have it on your bread. I mean, it's a great excuse to make up biscuits. And my husband has often said, Donna, the only reason you fix biscuits is because you can put these marmalades and these preserves that you make on them. It's a great carrier. And I'll tell you, it tastes so good. It's delicious over ice cream, waffles. It is fabulous. So it's worth the effort. And there are so many delicious types of peaches out there. So peach and orange conserve. Oh, what a great recipe. In fact, I've got a whole bunch of peaches, and I'm going to be doing it myself. It is a good thing to fix. Absolutely marvelous. 4th of July, can you believe it's coming up? It's hard for me to believe that it's coming up. Before we know it, it's going to be here. Fireworks special, all kinds of wonderful activities. I know in your communities you're going to be attending a lot of different things. You know, you can go online at pps.org. They have a special documentary on all of the different types of fireworks. If you wanted to educate your kids about the different ones, they're called glitter palms or Roman candles, crackles, rings. There's all kinds of patterns that they've got. Well, you can go there, and it's all under their fireworks section. And then there are lenses. If you're going to be going out to a fireworks display of any kind, it's so much fun when you can do it. We've done it many times through the years, sharing it with friends and family, having a picnic, doing something special. The lenses you can get there are firework glasses. I had never heard of this. The lenses are made of a special film that turns every point of light into a colorful starburst. It transforms any fireworks show into an awe-inspiring experience. Well, I think it's awesome anyway. So for information on how to get your free pair, you can go to rainbowsymphony.com/freestuff.html. Who knew? Well, this is Donna Sebo. We're out of time. I'm so delighted you were able to join me today. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Tomorrow we're talking about unique kids. Be back here same time, same place. This is Donna. Take care. Have a fabulous day. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.